You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This podcast contains information, theories, and speculation based on the A Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. It can and will spoil future episodes of the HBO television series Game of Thrones. This is your one and only spoiler warning. If you're looking for our non-spoiler podcast on Game of Thrones, please look at our feed archive for Sunday night and Tuesday afternoon releases, or visit baldmove.com for our entire catalog. Hey everybody, welcome back to the spoiler edition, this time for episode 509 of HBO's Game of Thrones television series, entitled The Dance of Dragons. You know, I don't have a whole lot to say in the introduction. I think this was a bummer of an episode, not just because the Shireen was burning. Now, that clearly that colored a lot of stuff, but up to that point, I wasn't super impressed with the stuff I was seeing. I think that, you know, if you go back and listen to the spoiler editions that I did previously in the season, I was pretty excited about the idea of swapping Jaime and Bronn for the two kind of forgettable King's Guardians down in Dorne. And you know, even some of the other changes, I was really hopeful that that would be more interesting. And somehow they've made it less interesting than it was in the books, which I think is incredible. I feel like, you know, and I think that came across in my choice of Audible quote to use. I found the resolution of the Dany Drogon Great Pits scenario less interesting than the book version. You know, and the really surprising thing, the thing that they've been able to do well is Arya's plot. And I just feel like they massively crapped the bed on They've simultaneously rushed her development as an assassin and also drugged their feet about key reveals to where now the development they're doing in this episode and presumably the next just feels kind of rushed. And, you know, I can't really figure it out. The pacing on this season outside of Hardhome in the first two episodes has just been really all over the map. It's really uncharacteristic of Game of Thrones. And, you know, I think as book readers, we were looking at this season to see kind of how the Double D's would be flying if they had to fly on their own. And even though the initial results are promising, I'm honestly more worried than ever. Now, maybe part of the problem is having to marry the new stuff that they had to develop to condense Dance down to something manageable with the stuff they know George is going to do with, you know, bringing it all together so they can keep telling the story. And everyone's first take, I think it's fairly universal that your first go through and Feast of Dance is kind of a what the fuck. You have to recalibrate your expectations. You have to get to know a bunch of new characters that you will begin to care for. And maybe this is kind of the example of the television show going through that awkward phase where they're simultaneously narrowing down and expanding the plot. But I don't know. I was pretty disappointed in the episode.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
But I don't want to harp too much on that. I do want to talk about Stannis, him being out of character. Because I got a lot of people emailing me, you know, arguing that essentially I was wrong. And I don't think they're wrong. I don't think they're wrong. And I'm going to talk about it now. You know, aside from the points I made in the main cast, which is essentially this is a man who loved his daughter, maybe the only thing in his world that he truly loves. The fact that this is a man who survived 18 months in a siege, living on nothing but horses, rats, shoe leather, and onions. This is a guy who would fold up shop, who kept fighting after losing the battle of the Blackwater Bay. This is a man who would fold after a single setback and burn his daughter. And people are like, well, you know, if he didn't do that, then everybody... I'm not arguing that eventually he wouldn't do it. I'm saying the way the show presented it, which is 20 men came and burnt your shit, time to burn your daughter, was too jarring for me, too much of a character change. And then I think two different people sent in the whole, well, you know, every time you hear someone that murders their children, like a Casey Anthony situation, everyone always says kind of how shocking it is. And, you know, no one says, oh, yeah, I figured, yeah, I had them pegged as a child murderer from way back. That's kind of persuasive, I guess. But, you know, all I can say is it didn't ring true for me. And, you know, the thing about him keeping Storm's End was he didn't even personally have a lot of commitment to that issue. He was following the orders of a brother that he kind of loathed out of a sense of duty and obligation to the laws of the realm and, you know, support for his family. That's the kind of gumption and determination and I will not give up attitude that he brings to bear. Also, a couple of quotes from the books that jumped out at me when I was reading coverage of the week. Stannis quoting, here's a quote from Stannis. Half of my army is made up of unbelievers. I will have no burnings. Pray harder. When people suggested that they offer up some sacrifice to the Lord of Light. If the double D's are correct and that this is something that George is eventually going to do in the books, you've got to really logically work backwards or suggest that Stannis is just being mind controlled in some way, which maybe that's the solution. And I don't know how interesting that is. You know, it kind of works in Lord of the Rings. I talked about Saruman mind controlling Theoden. Because we came in at the end of it and he was essentially waking up after doing all these tragic deeds and kind of fiddling while the Rohirrim were burning. I don't know if it works to actually watch a man be mind controlled and do a bunch of horrible things to his family. We'll see, I guess. The other quote is he was given instructions to his men on what would happen if he would die. It says it may be that we shall lose this battle, the king said grimly. This is talking about Stannis here. In Braavos, you may hear that I am dead. It may even be true. You shall find my sellswords nonetheless. The knight hesitated. Your grace, if you are dead, you will avenge my death and seat my daughter on the Iron Throne or die in the attempt. Again, this doesn't seem like a man who would jump to burning his only heir, someone he loved, at the drop of the hat. But on the other hand, this is the man who killed his little brother in cold blood with black magic. This is a man who has allowed men and women to be burned in an offering to appease a god that he doesn't really believe in. This is a man that's renowned throughout the kingdom for his lack of human compassion and mercy. So I don't think it's fair to say it's entirely without his character. It's just not within the character envelope that I was assigning to Stannis. And I do think that George has some work to do if he doesn't want the book reveal to feel very much like the show reveal and have a lot of people, you know, being skeptical of that change. You know, one final quote from the books that Eric I brought my attention to that suggests that this may be part of Stannis' overall plot. It's a quote, I believe this is from a Davos chapter. He's recounting the tale of the forging of Lightbringer. It says, 100 days and 100 nights he labored on the third blade. As it glowed white hot in the sacred fires, he summoned his wife. Nissa, Nissa, he said to her, for that was her name, bear your breast and know that I love you best of all that is in this world. She did this thing, why I cannot say, and Azor Ahai thrust the smoking sword through her living heart. It is said that her cry of anguish and ecstasy left a crack across the face of the moon, but her blood and her soul and her strength and her courage all went into the steel. Such is the tale of forging of Lightbringer, the Red Sword of Heroes. It's possible that they're building towards this, as Stannis thinking that he has to do something horrific to secure the safety of the realm. And I guess it would be in his character if he thought this was the only way to sacrifice his daughter. And this does echo, you know, what Azor Ahai here says, that know that I love you best of all that it is in this world. You could accurately say that about Stannis too. And I wonder if how dark we're going to get. Is every single hero that we meet in this series going to have, you know, some moment where they have to do something horrific to fully awaken their power? You know, is Bran going to have to eat Jojen? Is Jon going to have to strangle Ghost? Stannis going to have to burn his daughter? Is Dany going to have to sacrifice one of her dragons? Like, what is the worst case scenario for all these things? Is George going to make us endure them all? I don't know. We will see. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I got a lot of congratulations on my Extremely Sly. It's blindingly obvious where they're going with Arya's plot. Because, you know, I've slipped in a bunch this year. I can't think of any now that I'm on the spot, but a little puns that only book readers would get. That's actually not one of them. I was not thinking of that angle. I'm glad it worked that way, and I'm glad people enjoyed it, but I can't rightfully take credit for it. I was just kind of messing around and struck gold on that one. So thanks to everybody that caught and appreciated that. I should try to do... It's weird because trying and doing it sometimes, I'm worried that it'll be too cute and people will catch on. But it is fun to slip them in there every once in a while where they make sense. Let's move on to the first feedback we got. Double A Ron T said, "Help me out, fellow Double A Ron. I'm actually a single A Ron. That's the I got the Germanic spelling of Aaron from my grandfather, who was a first generation German immigrant. I'm named after him." So, and apparently Germans don't truck with vowels that you don't pronounce. So they don't need the double A. They're just a single A. But he says, "It does not seem like Melisandre is going back to the wall anytime soon. So what and how the fuck are they going to do Jon Snow? Will they save this for next season? Will they have him just warg into Ghost? I've never been very cool with that theory. Fuck John warging. He needs to be in the story in the flesh, even if that's zombie flesh. Lastly, does John really just die?" No. John can't die and stay dead in the sense of no longer being able to take an active role in Westeros. If John dies, that means that R plus L equals J is either flat out wrong or, worse, irrelevant. And since that's kind of the Valyrian cold rolled steel tin foil of for which all others are kind of judged, just no fucking way, man. There's no way that he can go away from R plus L equals J at this point. That being said, the burning of Shireen opens up the possibility that Stannis will maybe send Melisandre back to the wall just to get her out of his sight, that he's disgusted. It's a reminder of his failure here. Perhaps after the Battle of Winterfell is over, which is presuming they can get through that. This episode, or I guess it could be he sends her back at the end, you know, in the course of this episode, and she makes her way to the beginning of the next. I doubt that he actually gets resurrected in this episode. I'm pretty sure they'll kill him. Doubt that they get the resurrect. I believe that they'll leave that to be a cliffhanger, just like it is in the book, because it's an effective one. I'm not sure what you have against the John Warging theory, because the important thing is for his soul to be able to go somewhere after his death, so that however his body gets restored, either by white undead zombie magic or by Lord of the Light nonsense, he'll be able to quantum leap back into that sexy-ass bot of his. And remember, if it's just Melisandre, every evidence we see says that bringing someone back using Lord of the Light magic diminishes them. In the same way that, you know, a more extreme version of the white magic, because the whites come back and they have echoes of their former memory that they can access, apparently, but they don't appear to have any true free will or motivating force. And I think that the more you get resurrected, it seems like that the more that happens to you with the Lord of the Light stuff. At least that's the experience of Beric Dondarrion. That's kind of what they hint's going on with Kat and her Lady Stoneheart configuration. So I think you need warging. You need some way to preserve the authentic aspect of someone's intellect and soul. And also, you know, if you look at the Varamyr chapters in Dance with Dragons, the whole purpose of those is to suggest that a human can have a second life in an animal. Why throw those in if you don't want to raise the prospect of John warging? Also, the show has set up a convenient visual motif for warging, you know, the Bran's eyes clouding over effect, which they didn't have to do. I mean, we would have all got it if he touches the trees and his eyelids kind of flutter and close, or, you know, they show his eyes and then Summer. They didn't have to do that. And I kind of wonder if they introduced that motif just so they can use that as shorthand without explaining it with John. Like, John dies, his eyes are open, and then they cloud over white, and, you know, white in the sense of color. And then it pans over to Ghost, and he kind of, like, you know, maybe his ears perk up, or there's something that changes in his eyes. You know, maybe he's, like, going crazy with them. You know, he's chained up or in some other way he's going crazy, and then suddenly a calm comes over him. I think that would be kind of cool. And it would also give the show only guys something to really sink their teeth into in the off season. Like, you know, same thing we've been debating for years. Exactly how is this going to come back? How is he going to get out of Ghost? How is he going to get resurrected? Is it going to be as a white? Is it going to be with Melisandre comes back, etc.? So I think it's, they've done a good job with everything at the Wall and north of the Wall. That's the one thing that I can't really fault them for at all. I think they've done a really good job on.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Jared P. asked a related question. Is there any other way for this season to end with something other than For the Watch? I understand the value of the cliffhanger, but has the show done a good enough job setting up an outcome other than death for Jon Snow? Personally, I was hoping for an optimistic end to this season. Dany moving on Westeros, Sansa going to take back the North, something. One or both may happen, but not at the end. Jon will die and end the season. Yeah, I actually was surprised. I thought that they would have Dany's ride on Drogon be the very last thing we see, for all the reasons you said. You know, I was underwhelmed by it. I thought the book version was better, but it's still a hell of a moment in the show and a great kind of finally moment for show watchers that have been waiting for something like this. So the way I see it, there's a couple things that could go down this finale. You could have the Battle of Winterfell. I think that's too long and complicated to complete this season. I'd be surprised if they show much of it at all. I think they'll show like the prelude of it. I'm thinking Davos will either replace the pink letter or he'll arrive just before Jon gets the actual pink letter. And that will rouse Jon to with the knowledge that Ramsay has a sister. And you know, I'm still finding it hard to believe that Jon will abandon his post for any reason at this point in a post-Hardhome world, but whatever. Jon's death is probably what they'll close on now. That's probably going to be the hammer. A small moment of triumph for Sansa. Perhaps she escapes with Theon while Ramsay's away. As a closing moment, that would be kind of uplifting. Arya being blinded as punishment for killing Meryn Trant, because that seems like it's certain to go down. You know, that would be cool. I would like to see her kill Meryn Trant and just ignore the Thin Man, get blinded as a punishment, and then come back and do the Thin Man right to show, kind of in a ham-fisted way, how immature she was, you know, before Meryn Trant, and like, you know, her awkward spying and how obvious her assassination attempt was going to be with the vinegar and the clams, oysters, and cockles, to her post-blindness awesomeness. I don't know if I think that's the greatest way to handle it, but I could see them thinking along those lines. You got Cersei's shame walk and reveal of Sir Robert Strong, which is kind of going to be awesome for both of those reasons. And also the return and then early departure of Kevin Lannister, which they set up last episode or this episode. And I wonder if they'll give us like the poo-poo platter version of this, where they'll set up all these threads in motion throughout the scene, the hour. And then the last 5 minutes, you'll have 30-second vignettes to see like Theon and Sansa trekking through the snow. Arya waking up from taking whatever medicine and she's blind. And that's the reveal. And they kind of go through this, you know, Cersei finishing her shame walk and tearfully approaching the Red Keep, and she sees Sir Robert the Strong and is like, excellent. Varys popping up and killing Kevin Lannister and monologuing a bit. And then that leads right into the For the Watch moment. It would be kind of cool to like have the final 10 minutes be all the best parts of the episode, all crammed one right after another. So it's kind of like this breathless runaway freight train feeling. Because otherwise, I mean, they got to do something special. Or I think there's going to be a lot of people that are not as excited about next year of Game of Thrones as they could be. Next up, Dan, I was watching an inside episode of the latest Game of Thrones, and David Benioff said something that caught my interest. When talking about the death of Shireen, he said, when George first told us about this, does that mean this is a book spoiler? Are we to assume that in The Winds of Winter or A Dream of Spring, Stannis will sacrifice Shireen? Will Melisandre and Selyse sacrifice Shireen in Stannis' absence? Or is George merely making a suggestion for the direction of the show? I want to get your take on this and see what you thought. Well, Dan, I thought the way it was worded kind of implies that George told them it was a major plot point, that might it not necessarily go down this way in the books. Another way you could say this is that George is like, hey, it'd be cool in the show if you did this. And that offers up some delicious speculation that maybe George is like secretly sabotaging the show to make sure that it's the shittier version of the books. I don't know that he's that kind of person to do that, but I think that's kind of funny. In the books, I hope they do a better job of selling us the desperation of the moment, or for the stakes to be much, much higher for Stannis to pull this shit. I like your suggestion that Mel and Selyse could be behind it, Melisandre and Selyse. If that's the case, though, why fuck with Stannis' character like they did on the show? Like, I get the whole Otten Martin's razor and character economy, but, you know, if Selyse and Melisandre end up burning her in the books against Stannis' wishes or without his knowledge or consent, I'll be pissed that they did this in the show, because you can't root for Stannis after this. Like, everybody making the apologies for Jaime. There's a difference from pushing out the youngest son of a northern lord that you're a rival, someone you don't give a shit about, out the window to cover up your incestuous relationship with your sister. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying that is a huge step down in like no point of return than burning your own daughter that just three episodes ago you confessed your love for. At least to me, you know, I don't think Jaime would push his own kid out the boat. So there's like a limit to like how foul his behavior. If you burn your own daughter for a cause you believe in, what the hell won't you do? That's kind of the difference I see in there. So the other thing I want to talk about is that some have suggested that this awkward shot of Melisandre looking into the flames as Stannis' camp starts to burn around her indicates that she knew the attack was coming, but chose not to tell Stannis so that he would be desperate enough to allow his daughter to be burnt so that she can then try some of this impressive blood magic she's been trying to work up. And I think that's an interesting angle, but I'd like to see it confirmed either next season or better yet in a Melisandre POV chapter in Winds of Winter. I mean, we already know that Melisandre is manipulating Stannis and others around her to believe that she's more powerful she is, but we don't know to what end. And I'd like to see some more evidence for that. Patience B says, do you think it's possible that Dorne has spies like so many others do? Has he received word of what's happening in King's Landing? Maybe he has no reason to fear Cersei. He could see Jaime as a decent guy, and this would make sending his sons to King's Landing feel safe to do. He knows Marcella is in danger in Dorne. Dorne seems to have a good heart and genuinely care about Marcella for far more than for political reasons. I believe that Trystane truly loves his betrothed. Everyone knows that Tommen is sweet and certainly know Joffrey, and King's Landing is clearly the better bet to keep Marcella and his son safe. On a side note, realistically, how much time should go by before everyone knows that Cersei is in a cell and King's Landing is ripe for the taking by anyone with half a brain? Well, if Dorne has spies, then he should know that Tommen isn't exactly in charge of King's Landing. And yeah, maybe Jaime is a good dude, and maybe Marcella is in danger, but to send your heir as a hostage to King's Landing to your sworn enemy is just foolhardy, unless he has a truly epic plan. And honestly, I'll be very disappointed if we get through the finale this weekend without knowing any more than we already do about Dorne and Prince Dorne's plot. We need some version of his vengeance, justice, fire, and blood speech to make Dorne even remotely worth it. And it's got to be I mean, honestly, if it's just deploying Quentin at this point, I'll be pissed. Because we already know Quentin doesn't go anywhere in the books. Or at least I'd be surprised if he's not as badly hurt as everyone thinks, and that it's all a ruse, and so I need to see that kind of speech with some real fire in its belly applied to a really solid plan B in Doran's arsenal, or I'm going to be, you know, I just won't understand what they've been doing in Dorne. Like, why do Dorne at all if you're not going to make it compelling? And maybe it was a miscalculation. Maybe they thought the Sand Snakes would be more popular than they are, but, you know, it's boring. They kind of fucking ruined the Laria as a character. The Sand Snakes haven't been well established as really good bad guys or bad good guys or anything like that. And Jaime and Dorne have been kind of a waste of their characters. So as a side note, for your side note, Cersei will most certainly be out of the clutches of the High Sparrow before the end of this finale, and arguably more dangerous than ever, judging by her internal monologue on seeing Robert Strong for the first time. Also, I know some people hinted that maybe the reveal for Dorne will be that he's hiding Aegon, or Fagon, if you think he's the fake Aegon. But honestly, I don't see the show indulging in either Quentin or Aegon. Those are likely fake outs in the book and not important to the main storyline. There's even a lot of tinfoil evidence that suggests that Dany has been told in prophecy that these are all fakes and pretenders that are not going to ultimately matter to a hill of beans. So even internally within the larger A Song of Ice and Fire universe, that makes sense too. So I don't see the show indulging in fake outs and diversions, because they don't typically do that. They adapt material they think is crucial somewhat more successfully than most usually. This season, they just had a bad run of luck. Tomer brought my attention to a new George Martin Live Journal entry He says, as far as the Knight's King, in the books, he's a legendary figure akin to Lan the Clever and Brandon the Builder, and no more likely to have survived in the present than they have today. Or than they have, rather. This was from this week on his live journal. And he was talking about the Knight's King. I thought that was interesting that he says in the books, as he allows for the TV shows to be different. But if so, the TV show, I think, is even less likely to indulge in ancient stories and prophecies than the books. Indeed, damn near all the prophecy that we kind of obsess over as book readers has been excised by the show. So my read on this is that a lot of the stuff about the Night's King having connections to the ancient Starks and to the Night's Watch is just not going to matter or be incorrect, which is sad because there's a lot of good lore to build on there. My guess is that the legends are going to be interesting for what they tell us about the current characters and foreshadowing their fates, not so much in the sense of them having predictive powers or allusions to something grander. I mean, maybe that makes sense. We've got the legend of the Rat Cook told to us, which is an obvious commentary on the Frey betrayal of Robb Stark. But nobody seriously suggests that Walder Frey is a fucking Rat King reborn. He has become the Rat King of prophecy. He is the Rat Cook with his ladle, Ratbringer, sent by the Night's King to eat every last fucking chicken in his fucking room. I mean, you know, sometimes that can just be a literary device to show parallels and foreshadow. It doesn't have to be like a literal coming true of every single prophecy. And sometimes prophecies can be wrong. And which ones you listen to, which sources they come from are important. So maybe we're just taking some of this shit that old Nan said a little too seriously. She's just a crazy old lady telling bedtime stories to frighten children. Maybe. Josh H. said, in the Hard Home main cast, you and Jim were discussing Valyrian steel blades that were known, and you had mentioned ice. You were saying, given its name, perhaps it was meant to kill the others, but it reminded me of a quote from the first book that gave me a different idea. The quote's from the very first Catelyn chapter as she watches Ned clean ice. 400 years old it was, and as sharp as the day it was forged. The name it bore was older still, a legacy from the Age of Heroes, when Starks were kings in the North. Now, granted, perhaps the original ice was some sort of old Bronze Age blade, but I have another theory. Could it be the blade of an other? Perhaps worn one in combat, perhaps as a result of a truce? Perhaps one of the early Long Nights ended at Winterfell, perhaps giving the ancient keep its name as the place where winter literally fell? I actually think that's pretty cool, Josh. I'm not sure how we'd ever find out if it was true, but it's a nice headcanon you've got there. And until you included that quote, I had completely forgotten that ice wasn't a truly ancient ancestral blade. As far as Winterfell goes, the name could hold a lot of different meanings. As you suggest, it can literally mean the place where winter is broken, which could refer to some ancient battle against the White Walkers, or it could mean that Winterfell is a traditional stronghold of the North that northern commoners flock to. They have this whole winter's town right outside the gates of Winterfell. Because it's capable of staying warm. It's got geothermal vents, and it's built on hot springs. It keeps it warm. It's got the glass garden, so it can produce food throughout the harshest of winters. And it's the key to the North for surviving this winter. Fell can also mean cruel or terrible or fierce. It could just be more northern fatalism, like winter is coming. So it's all interesting stuff. And you know, dap for you if it turns out that one of the secrets in the crypts of Winterfell is a badass other blade that comes in important later on the season or series, but we'll have to see. Nick W. says, something I noticed in my first watch of episode 9, Dance of Dragons, was this letter that Stannis gives to Davos to deliver to Jon Snow at the Wall. I know that most watchers realize this is a plot device to drive Davos away from Stannis' camp. But from a book reader's perspective, is this letter supposed to be the infamous pink letter from the books, supposedly written by one Ramsay Snow Bolton and delivered to Jon Snow before his stabbing? If so, it seems odd that Davos is delivering the letter as opposed to sending the letter via Raven, especially if the author of the pink letter is supposed to be a suspenseful item of discussion like it is for us book readers. Are we as book readers supposed to infer that Stannis is the author of the pink letter and the contents within are inherently false, just to invoke a reaction from Jon so that he can send troops and supplies to Winterfell? The letter, instead of being as it is in the book, could be a straightforward note from Stannis informing Jon of how his men are dying, his supplies have been burned, and he needs help from Jon to defeat the Boltons. Stannis could also pull a Ramsay has Theon and Sansa angle, if he knows about such from Melisandre or rumblings around his camp, and use that as a last chance to get Jon's help. So as you point out in your email, the problem with Davos being the carrier of the pink letter is that it's hard to believe that anything in there could move Jon to leave the wall at this point. And if Stannis is obviously the writer of the Pink Letter, then most of what is fascinating about it from a book and Al's perspective is missing. But what if Stannis tells a fib about who Ramsay is holding as his wife? What if in the show he lies and tells Jon it's all about Arya? One thing that I think the show did very well in season one is establish how much Jon meant to Arya and vice versa, and that point has been fuzzily kept in the minds of the show watchers via Arya's attachment to Needle, which of course was Jon's gift. Jon thinking that Arya was in danger is the only thing I think plausibly would have him be like, you know what, fuck it, I'm leading a ranging party straight up Ramsay's asshole. And they could just show Arya and Jon in the Needle scene on a previously on Game of Thrones, and I think viewers would be on the same page. Do I buy that he would have the same reaction as Sansa? If so, I think it would be more of an intellectual sense of duty. And, well, it's my last family member. Maybe I should go save them. Although he knows about Bran and Rickon and the TV show, which is different from the books. But Arya, I would buy. Arya, I would buy that he would betray his duty to go save her. Now, that would also give us a little bit of intrigue surrounding this letter. Not like in the books, like it's a whodunit, but more the show Pink Letter is all about Stannis sitting on his throne of lies made of Shireen ashes and what that means for Jon, because viewers might be shitting their pants thinking, oh God, Jon is going to be walking to a trap featuring not just one but two madmen, and we know Mel is hot for Jon's blood, and this is going to be bad. And then bam, they hit us for the watch moments and the et tu Ollie moments. And I think that would be pretty satisfying because they're looking at this one possible danger, just kind of like we are in the show with this or the books, this pink letter overtly threatening Jon. And then boom, they hit us with the for the watch moment. So I think that would be kind of cool. Allison T has some questions about Cersei's prophecy from earlier in the season. At this point, what is the purpose of having a flashback? I mean, I guess they may tie it back together here in the last episode somehow, but since they left out the whole thing about the Valonqar or whatever, it seems strange that they went through the effort to put that in. They made a big deal about how they were never going to include flashbacks and all this stuff, and so it was a big deal and this episode is going to have a flashback, but to me that didn't really seem to be worth all the hype. And I was super excited about it being there. I mean, she hasn't referred to it at all, and we haven't seen any more glimpses of it. Plus, I feel like this last episode is going to be so crammed full of stuff, why bring a flashback into it as well? Well, Allison, I'm still holding out hope for the Valonqar stuff, and I appreciate you reminding me, because I just about forgotten it, the way the season opened. I said at the time that the way the scene was filmed, to me, opened up the possibility that there is a part two to this vision, where they will fill in the part about the little brother murdering her. And I could see them revisiting this in the episode as Cersei sits and reflects in jail to bookend the season. Or I could see them opening next season with part two of the vision. And presumably this will be interesting because Cersei is unreasonably afraid of Tyrion. And him advising Dany will kick those fears into overdrive. Just like her reminiscing on the earlier, first part of the prophecy had her unreasonably fixate on Margaery to her detriment. So I think a lot of sharp viewers will have a field day with the younger brother theories in the same way that we do, since they essentially have the same info. Foe. Oh, I bet it's Jaime. Oh, I bet it's the Hound. I bet it's Bran fucking Stark all warged up in the Hodor, etc. I mean, that's fun to do. And I hope that the show puts fun little tinfoil theories for the listeners to pick up on. That would be cool. Allison also did a bit of Greyjoy speculation that I'm going to save for next week because we're going to be tearing into casting news for season 6 next week, and we will have a lot of Iron Islanders salivating over this information because they're totally gross that way, just drooling around and going around in their boats and having their smoking hands of doom and all that kind of stuff. They'll be happy, though. Rusty A said, Arya's story could go one of three ways. Cool. Arya returns to the brothel, gets chosen by Trant, and poisons him before he can have his way with her. Way too predictable, he says. Cooler. Faced with the choice between personal revenge and continuing her assassin training, Arya lets Trant leave the city, figuratively severing her ties to her past and becoming no one, which he deems is the most likely to happen. And coolest, we see another underage girl being chosen by Trant. They go into the bedroom. Before he can have his way with her, Trant falls to the ground, poisoned and dying. The girl pulls off a mask, revealing the killer to be Arya, saying, that's for Cereo Pharrell. So, there's no way in hell we get the cooler version, which is, you said you think is the most likely, because Arya's not ready to become no one yet. Jaqen has said it. The Waif has said it. Her bearing needle has said it. I just don't see it. I also don't see the coolest version happening either, because if Jaqen gives her a face when he knows, and I do believe he knows, I mean, come on, that she's lying to his face and going off script on her mission, then he's a fool. Which leaves us the cool version in which she kills Trant for revenge and is punished by Jaqen, again, probably by blinding her. That's what I think is going to go down. Josh L. says, I have to credit the History of Westeros podcast for this, but I also agree with the prediction that the Harpies will try to slay Rhaegal and Viserion after witnessing the danger of Drogon last week. That's how those two will get out. It's only a matter of time before they're big enough to break those chains, and I'm guessing our last shot of Meereen this season will be Tyrion, Jorah, and Daario et al. Witnessing from the top of the pyramid, the two remaining dragons going nuts on Meereen. I think that is a fantastic take, Josh. I'd love to see the Harpies overreach and try to kill the dragons only to get all Quentin'd. I'd love to see the two dragons nesting on top of the pyramids as you look out and the city's kind of partially in flames. I think that'd be a very cool visual image to end on. By the way, the History of Westeros podcast is great if y'all haven't tried it. I haven't had much time to listen to other podcasts this season with my expanded spoiler duties and me and Jim feverishly working on our coverage for season one of True Detective, but they were a mainstay for me last year, and they had some really excellent information.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Thomas J. So Ollie's definitely going to be the Brutus to John Caesar, and Double D's love to continue the trend of Sam accidentally giving him advice, which will ultimately not go well for John. If in Elio and Linda's review of Hardhome, they pointed out how giving Ollie the for the watch moment would cheapen it as it becomes about a single disagreement with the action rather than institutional rebellion, which made me wonder if they can pull off the institutional rebellion side convincingly. The only named characters in the Night's Watch are Sam, Ed, and Alistair Thorne. Sam won't partake in it. At this point, do you feel this moment can be pulled off despite the distance from the Night's Watch? Yeah, I mean, I think they can pull it off. The question is, can they pull it off well? And they have made it a point to show Bowen Marsh and introduce him by name at least once earlier in the season and show the other high mucky mucks of the Watch, all frowning and looking disapproving and kind of like a little you know, cluster of hens clucking. So they get their faces in front of the viewers. And that might be news to you, because while the camera swings on them every time John mutters about his decisions being unpopular with them, I don't think Jim would be able to identify who or what they are at gunpoint. I think Elio and Linda, though, miss their mark. It's not like it's only going to be Ollie that does the stabbing. It's going to be Ollie front and center, with maybe Alistair Thorne and other less recognizable brothers lined up behind them. Hell, they might throw in Dolores Ed there too, except I think after last episode, Hard Home, that him and John are solid again. But I would argue that they more than established the fact that the old school hardline brothers just don't agree with John, and they think that he's dangerous. And Ollie's just thrown in there to give us that recognizable face and to make the betrayal more shocking and personal. I'll be disappointed, honestly, if it's just a solo act. I mean, going back to the Caesar thing, I just got done listening to Dan Carlin's Death Throes of the Old Republic. And he talks about how, you know, Brutus was kind of a protege of Caesar. And maybe that assassination wouldn't be as popular in the public's imagination if it wasn't for that personal angle. If it was just business, it's not as interesting as if it's personal. So I don't think it's going to be just Ollie. That's dumb. If it is, that is dumb. But I think Ollie frontlining it, or even being the second or third knives going into John, that's where it'll be effective, because it adds that emotion to it. You also mentioned you don't personally buy Alistair Thorne assassinating John. I didn't read that part of your email, but you alluded to it, that he's too much of a good guy in the show. I don't actually think that's true, because I think Alistair can kill John and not have it be personal. You know, it's like, you got a good heart, kid, but you're going to kill us all. I thought that was a great line. But I will say it would be kind of cool if Alistair actually tries to defend John and ends up being killed as well. That'd be a nice moment. Like, say what you will about Thorne, but when the chips are down and the choices are stark, he's loyal to his vows and to his watch and his Lord Commander. That would kind of be an interesting redemption for him. Donnie from Georgia says, I have a theory. Going off the idea that Jack and Hagar is Syrio, could the look that Jack and gave Arya when she told him the thin man wasn't hungry, him debating to tell her that he, Syrio, wasn't dead after all, that he knew Arya saw Meryn Trant and wants to exact her revenge, he would have to know that Meryn Trant was in town. You know, Donnie, I would actually pee myself a little bit if there was even a glimmer of direct evidence from the show that Syrio is Jacken. That theory is correct, but no, I think you're reading too much into the scene, but your heart's in the right place. To be honest, while my little boy heart would love to see Syrio turn out to be Jacken, my grown-ass man heart is starting to appreciate the motif of Arya learning from her mentors and killing and taking pieces from each and moving on and become a stronger person. Syrio, the Hound, Jacken, arguably even Roose and Tywin. I like how she's being shaped in ways both subtle and gross to be this ultimate revenge machine. And I think George is going to lose some of that if it turns out that Arya is some River Tam-esque long-term project by the Faceless Men that they've had their eyes on since she was born, which is what the ultimate expression of the Syrio equals Jacken theory is, right? That this is like this big conspiracy and that he was there the whole time and assigned to Arya, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, before you ask, yes, I did do a spoiler segment on Jacken theories last season in episode 409. And as always, you can find a complete archive of the previous spoiler topics linked in every one of the show notes, which you can find accompanying the podcast on our website at baldmove.com, or it's probably exposed somewhere in your podcasting app, like the one that I use, Pocket Cast on Android. You swipe left to see the show notes for the particular show, and I'm sure it's similar or some other way to do it on iOS devices and other apps. Anyway, this brings us to the tinfoil topic. And I was going to do a tinfoil topic on the identity of the Sons of the Harpy from the book perspective, because it seems relevant after this week's episode, and I've been plugging in the Myrinese Blot blog for some time now, because I think it's the best, most on-point analysis of the whole Marine situation in Feast or Dance, especially if you hate the Dany sequences of the books. I think you really need to read this Untangling the Myrinese Knot essays, which you can find those at the MyriniseBlot.wordpress.com or by just Googling Myrinese Blot. Since Myrinese has kind of got that whole Mississippi thing where there's just an improbable number of E's and consonants and weird orders, and I find it as hard to remember how to spell right as Daenerys Targaryen, which is another fucking surprisingly hard thing to spell accurately, at least for my dumbass. But then I got two emails late in the week from fans who were spinning show foil of the highest grade, which, you know, again, is still tinfoil. And I decided to go with them instead. And this is going to be the last of the tinfoil segments because next week we'll be discussing casting news in its place. And in fact, this might be the last regular tinfoil segment for several years because, you know, please, George, for the sake of this segment, finish wins before next season. Preferably have it out by Christmas, number one, so I can get it as a present and spend my Christmas break reading it. Number two, so all the lunatics on Reddit and the Citadel can work it over with pipes and blowtorches and extract some truly excellent tinfoil from it in time for the podcast. Please, pretty please, for the sake of this spoiler segment, I would really appreciate it. Signed, Aaron, your fan. As it is, this is the 20th tinfoil podcast I've done, and with 3 two-part topics, that's 17 individual theories, and that's a lot. It's actually kind of crazy to think that there's so many interesting theories with just 2 books to go, and you can quibble about, you know, okay, well, one of those was the Varys is a mermaid, and one of those was Roose is a vampire, but still interesting stuff. For those of you interested in the book angle on the Sons of Harpies, the too long didn't read version is it's either the Shavepate or Resnick or Hisdar, and it's probably the Shavepate, which is ironic because it might turn out that the Sons of Harpies had nothing to do with the attempt on Dany's life at all, except that they totally do in the show, so now what? Well, here's your now what in the following emails. Barrett R. has a tinfoil theory that Varys is behind the Sons of Harpy. We haven't seen Varys this season, perhaps as a long setup to reveal that he is behind the Sons of the Harpy. They've been teasing that he could be someone close to Dany, and that could be to throw us off the real trail. We know Varys can exert influence across the Narrow Sea. It's possible he sent his little birds ahead to move events around Dany. I believe he genuinely wants to see her succeed, so the question is, what would be his motive? To me, it fits that he would want to make the environment in Essos undesirable to push her to move across to Westeros. And we know that he is on the continent, but has not presented himself. Surely, if he wanted to be seen by Dany, he would be seen by now. If Jorah and Tyrion went the scenic route, there had been ample time for him to reach Tyrion, search for Tyrion, give up, and then head for Dany. The only mystery in Essos this season are, where's Varys, and who's behind the Harpy? As a final thought on the theory, why would Varys risk such an action? He knows she has survived much more, and now has Barristan and other skilled fighters around to protect her. So, I don't think that Varys is really behind the Sons of Harpy, but if he is, I'll say that while she has arguably survived worse, inciting a citywide revolt against her is pretty risky, even with Barristan or Jorah or Daario or whomever around the protector. I mean, shit happens, and that's a really high-stakes play for Varys to make. Which brings me to the next email from the enigmatically named Tree Killer. Don't let Bran find out. You know, that's bad juju with the old gods. Anyway, Tree Killer says, on the show, it has been an open question who the Sons of the Harpy were. The leader has been either Hisdar or Daario. In my humble opinion, it's now confirmed to be Daario, as Hisdar is dead, killed by the Sons of the Harpies. Killing her own leader would, after all, gain them nothing. One, motive. The Sons of the Harpy are a false flag operation with the intent of inciting Dany to kill all of the former masters. I like starting off with the false flag operation. We're in loose change territory. They're originally composed of the Second Sons, but initiated a few freedmen later on. This is why we now see some Sons of the Harpy in slave dress. They're led by the Harpy, a.k.a. Daario. He was a slave and he hates the masters. That is why he got the Second Sons to join Dany in the hopes of overthrowing and killing them. Okay. If this is true, why is he lobbying Dany to get the fighting pits back open? I mean, I agree. It seems like the Sons of Harpy are at least equally comprised of the former masters the former slaves as they are of the former masters, if not more so. It's the former slaves who have really gotten the shaft in Dany's regime, if you think about it. She executed their representative on her council. She's allowed the fighting pits to reopen, which seem popular, but we know these aren't free man fighting. And the Harpies might know that as well, which would anger them and make them think Dany's a fool. We know the crowd at large went from Misa, Misa, to hiss in a single scene, so that anger is very real. Back to Tree Killer's point. The turning point. At first, this all goes as planned. They take Yunkai. They move on to Meereen. But after they leave Yunkai, the wise masters reassert themselves. This convinces Daario that all the masters must be killed. He's happy when Danny sends him and his second son to retake Yunkai and to kill all the wise masters, but at the last minute, Jor convinces her to send his Dar to negotiate. And she instructs him to tell Daario that it was Jorah who changed her mind. Unfortunately for him, his Dar is successful, and they agree to reabolish slavery if the mixed slave master council is established and the fighting pits are reopened. This is the key moment when he decides that she will not kill the masters unless she's forced to. The plan. Daario must first eliminate his advisors to Danny, rival advisors to Danny. Who's the first to go? Jorah. A boy gives a scroll to Sir Barristan that implicates Jorah as a spy. Jorah first says that this comes from Tywin, but is unlikely for several reasons. Why does Tywin care? When Joffrey mentions Danny in the small council, he dismisses her as a threat. Also, does he even know that Jorah has joined Danny and is no longer a spy? How could he? Daario is behind this. Let me ask you a relevant question. How would Daario know that Jorah is the traitor? I mean, I can't believe it could be a lucky guess. And it's hard to argue that Tywin wouldn't care, as he cared very much about it in the show, citing her three dragons and skilled advisors as something to be a threat. And who else would send the scroll but Tywin? Who else would have access to the spy documentation that was signed in the king's own hand? At this time, he also forms the Sons of the Harpy. The Sons of the Harpy, as I said previously, are a false flag operation. They want people to think they are the masters. If the Sons of Harpy were really great masters, why would they dress as them? They wear a mask to hide their face, but not their class? This only makes sense in the context of a false flag. But then White Rat is killed by the Sons of the Harpy. Daario knows where the Sons of the Harpy is hiding because he is their leader. Why does he want them arrested? Because he gambles that Mos Hadar will kill him, and then Dany will execute Mos Hadar, turning the slaves against Dany. Then, she will have to kill the masters to appease them. Tellingly, Daario says there's no need to question the Son of the Harpy because he has already done so. He doesn't want Danny to discover that the Sons of the Harpy is in fact a second son. Cleverly, this also eliminates Mos Hadar as a rival advisor. And here's where I think the theory starts to have some legs. Maybe Jorah getting exiled was just a fortunate occurrence to him, which maybe even emboldened him to take action against Danny's other advisors. I don't know if Daario ever truly respected Barristan, for example. I thought he saw them as maybe too over the hill and far too sentimental. Continuing, he says, next he plans to eliminate Hisdar, Grey Worm, and Sir Barristan in one fell swoop. When Dany is holding court, he tells her that Sir Barristan doesn't need to be there, so Sir Barristan goes to patrol with Grey Worm. Seizing the opportunity, he stages a massive attack by the Son of the Harpy. He kills Barristan, but fails to kill Grey Worm. Then he advises her to round up the leaders of the families, including Hisdar. His plan is foiled again when he instead marries her. This stops the attacks, and he accuses Hisdar of being their leader, but this doesn't work, so he decides to kill him. He stages the attacks in a fighting pit. If Hisdar is the only one killed, it ruins the false flag because Hisdar is a master, but if he's killed in the chaos, it provides cover. Also, both the Second Sons and Sons of the Harpy feature sons in their name. True, and this is a show change, because in the books, they're the Stormcrows. I can actually see this as kind of supporting the evidence that Euron and Daario are the same person, as we discussed a few weeks earlier, because Euron's motivation to get Dany to leave Essos ASAP would line up here as well, and what better way to get her to abandon her cause than to see it as hopeless. But on the other hand, it's a bit of a spoiler for the next podcast, where we consider casting news, but apparently they're holding a casting call for Euron Greyjoy right now. If they're different people in the show, there's no way they can be the same people in the book. Is it possible that the Sons of the Harpy are essentially a leaderless movement of the people? Because if you don't buy that, then they have to have a leader. And the assumption is it has to be a leader that we already know to have any kind of impact. With Hisdar dead, the only real suspect is Daario. Who else could it be? I'm interested to hear what you guys think. Is it possible that the Sons of the Harpy are a leaderless movement? Who is exactly behind them? Do you need it to be someone that we know and have met already for that to be interesting to you? As I mentioned in the main cast, that could be fulfilled just by having it be the warlocks of Karth or the merchant kings of Karth. I mean, there's a lot of ways you could resolve this, but I thought this was interesting and maybe could use some more research and some more thought to it. Anyway, as always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider helping support Jim and I making our free content available by joining our club at club.baldmove.com. lots of cool features, ad-free feeds. You never have to listen to me talk about this crap again. You get access to expanded content like our Lunch with Jim and Aaron's, our live taping of our podcast, some other things like live watches that we'll probably be getting back to doing with the new Walking Dead coming out this summer, and a lot more things that we're about to debut. And most importantly, it helps us continue doing what we're doing because we just simply couldn't do it without your direct support. If that's too much for you, again, amazon.baldmove.com. If you're shopping on Amazon, please remember to use that link because it's free to you. It costs you nothing. You get the full Amazon experience. We just get a tiny cut of Amazon's profit. It doesn't cost you more in shipping or handling or anything like that. Amazon.baldmove.com. And for everyone that has supported us, thank you from the bottom of my heart. We'll be back next week with another spoiler edition. We'll be back Sunday night with the Instant Cast. You can send in feedback at GameOfThrones@baldmove.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Until the next time, have a great weekend.